Today is Monday, November 9, 2020. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
I'm doing very well today, Tom. Hope you are too.
I am. Thank you very much. Glad to hear it. Last time we were talking about some of the challenges that you faced in Joshua Tree, talked about the fee demonstration program and how you were able to use that to your advantage with some problems you were having. Talked about the inholdings in the park and how complicated it was to track down the people that own the lands and try to work out funding sources to recover those lands and get them back into the National Park Service holdings. And I wonder if there were other things that you dealt with at Joshua that you'd like to recount.
Well, I've been thinking about Joshua Tree. It's an interesting, I guess this is the 10th interview. It's been a great opportunity for me to spend some time thinking about 35 years. So I was thinking about Joshua Tree and some of the things that we worked on. The fee demonstration program, I think we covered in the last interview, that I thought it had become too gummed up with the bureaucracy of Washington, D.C. And that's just my opinion. I'm sure that the legislative branch doesn't see it that way. But yeah, climbers. One of the things I thought about when I was there were no fees in the upper campgrounds of the park, and the park had basically, in my opinion, been taken over by climbers. Well, not the park, but the campgrounds had been taken over by climbers. I think I might have mentioned to you that one New Year's Eve, I was riding along with the chief ranger, and all the other rangers were on duty. And we went through Hidden Valley Campground, and there were bonfires all over, and a lot of partying going on, and at least two beer bottles, empty beer bottles, were thrown at the chief ranger's patrol car as we drove through the campground. And that was indicative of how out of control some of the climbers were. Like I also mentioned that many of the climbers from the 60s and the 70s had settled around Joshua Tree and were quite respectful. But the new folks that, in my opinion, learned their climbing ethics on climbing walls and climbing gyms really didn't have much respect for the park.
Right, so you did cover that, yes.
So we used the fee program to clean up longtime residents of climbers that were just hanging out in Joshua Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what one of the issues that I wanted to bring up was during that patrol period, after I had gone home, the rangers responded to a fire, and a climber had been drinking excessively and decided that he would climb up on top of a large boulder and pour a gallon of white gas onto the indentation on the top of the boulder and then set it on fire. So the rangers responded. Fortunately, there wasn't a forest fire out of that, but they ended up citing him and took him to court, magistrate's court, and he was found guilty. It took about 2 or 3 months to do that. And after he was found guilty and fined whatever it was, $50 or $100, the rangers brought to my attention that he had been an associate editor of Climbing Magazine. So I wrote a letter to the editor of Climbers Magazine and expressed my concern about type of people that they were employing and how a lack of disregard in the national parks was not really what they wanted to be portraying.
Nice.
And credit of the people that run Climbers magazine, Climbing magazine, they fired him, which restored my confidence in the true climbers that have a great ethic about taking care of the places that they recreate in.
Yes.
So while we had some issues with climbers, and they still do, I mean, there's just so many of them, and the impact to the environment around the heavy use climbing areas is significant. I just think that climbers overall, are, especially at Joshua Tree, are very interested in protecting the park, and there's just a few folks that they need to self-police, as the case may be.
Yeah.
And throughout my time at Joshua Tree, it was frequently the climbers that showed up, especially on search and rescue, but also with land use, recreational use issues. They showed up and wanted to protect the park, so their vision of what the park could and should continue to be would be realized. Another thing that I don't think I mentioned the Eagle Mountain Mine controversy.
No, I don't think so.
So on the southeast corner of Joshua Tree National Park, in the 1940s, there's an area, around Eagle Mountain, that was Congress passed some legislation that took it out of the park so that it could be utilized for iron ore extraction.
Okay.
And this was a large open pit mine.
All right.
Probably, I don't know, 600 acres, 1,200 acres, something like that. And interestingly, in the 40s, 50s, that iron ore was extracted, shipped by rail car down into the Fontana area by Los Angeles to iron smelting plants. And it provided a very large percentage of the iron that was used in the construction of Los Angeles and the surrounding area as it expanded.
Hmm.
Well, part of the legislation said that if the mining operation ever ceased, that land would be returned to the national park.
Okay.
The national monument at the time. And there were two champions, Larry and Donna Sharpede, that studied the legislation and studied the history, and they took on an honorable effort of trying to take that land and have it restored back into the national park.
How do you spell Larry and Donna's last name?
Charpied.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Donna has since passed. But they were jojoba farmers at Desert in Arizona. In the east of the park in Desert Center in California.
That's J-O-J-O-B-A?
Yeah.
And jojoba. It's a kind of a, looks kind of like a date, and you can get an oil out of it.
Yeah, it's a large bushy plant.
Okay.
Being cultivated.
Desert, a desert plant.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the jojoba oil was even used in World War II for lubrication of machinery.
Oh, interesting. All right.
And there were many jojoba farms, as I understand it, supported by federal programs to continue to produce this jojoba oil.
Hmm.
It's now widely used in organic holistic medicines.
Okay.
Base, but it's also used directly for skin care. So most of those jojoba farms, after the government subsidies went away, went defunct. But Larry and Donna moved out of the Los Angeles area and came out to Desert Center and made their living as jojoba farmers.
So it's interesting because I would think that when the mining stopped, someone in the Park Service would have said, "Okay, we're taking the land back." And it's, you know, I'm thrilled to know that Larry and Donna actually took this on to get it back, but I'm kind of surprised that the agency didn't do it before them.
And Ernie Quintana, the superintendent that I replaced, was extremely supportive of their activities.
Okay.
And even going so far as to be told by Washington, D.C. that he would not attend a public meeting concerning that issue. So he took annual leave for a week.
Wow.
And he was off duty.
Good for him.
Didn't work too well with the powers that were. Of course, fortunately for him, the powers would be changed, and Fran Minella and Randy Jones were able to put him into a position in the Midwest region as the regional director, like I've mentioned.
Yeah.
So what was interesting to me was in the Coachella Valley at the time, Buford Kreitz, who had had a successful career as mayor of, I think, Coachella, city of Coachella, or one of those cities, and was active in the Sierra Club, worked out an arrangement. So the proposal became, instead of returning it to the national parks, that it would be used as the Eagle Mountain landfill. And this giant open pit mine would be converted into a landfill, and the trash from the greater Los Angeles area would be transported by rail car out to the Eagle Mountain mine and dumped into the ground.
Who came up with that proposal?
The Eagle Mountain Mining Corporation.
Uh-huh.
With the support of the greater Los Angeles area folks that were trying to deal with large-scale trash problems.
Yeah, yeah. Except that that's a little outside, I think, of the legislative intent there to allow mining, not to allow the storage of waste, garbage. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's how they interpreted the law and how their supporters interpreted the law.
Okay.
At the same time that was going on, the Greater Coachella Valley had to do a multi-species habitat conservation plan to meet the Endangered Species Act for all of the expansion that they wanted to have. And you have to remember there's some 11 cities in that area, population of about, at the time, 350,000 people, set to grow rapidly.
This is like a bedroom community to L.A.?
Well,
300,000 people, that's a big chunk of folks.
Well, it started in Palm Springs.
Okay.
And we all learned about Palm Springs because of Bob Hope.
Yeah.
And then more and more people started coming. And in the 50s, Palm Springs was a retreat area for the Rat Pack and Frank Sinatra and lots of Hollywood entertainers. In fact, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, part of their reimbursement for their work as actors, they received large tracts of land in the Coachella Valley area.
Oh.
It was converted into development. So the Coachella Valley's multi-species habitat conservation plan, which was put together by a couple of really good biologists, and with assistance from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. They worked out a deal through Buford Kreitz and the Sierra Club that, as part of the environmental compensation for the Eagle Mountain Mine, is that they would receive monies from the Los Angeles area, the Eagle Mountain Mine, and the Los Angeles area participants to offset some of their environmental impacts. And so the superintendent of the park, with the support of my regional director, and he became the director of the National Park Service, John Jarvis, we found ourselves on the other side of the argument with the Sierra Club, which Sierra Club is known for being supportive of parks, especially in the Grand Canyon Dam era.
Mm-hmm.
So I just found it highly ironic that the Sierra Club was supporting the Eagle Mountain Mine so that the multi-species habitat conservation plan for the Coachella Valley could be implemented.
So,
and be funded.
So let me make sure I get this right. First question for you is, Buford Kreitz, how do you spell Buford's last name?
C-R-I-T-E-S.
C-R-I-T-E-S. And Buford, in his role with the Sierra Club, was in agreement with Eagle Mountain and the city of Los Angeles to make the Eagle Mountain open pit into a landfill in exchange for funding for the multi-species habitat conservation plan.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it would have been mediation dollars.
And where did Larry and Donna, Sharpie, where did they come down on this?
They were the primary antagonists against the whole idea.
Okay. So the park wasn't alone.
No. In fact, I would have to say that Larry and Donna led, and the Park Service followed along.
Wow. What do you remember about Larry and Donna?
Very, very intelligent people that lived a very simple lifestyle. They had, I believe, 160 acres of jojoba farm, their own well, and Desert Center is, it's not an abandoned mining town, but the mining town at the time was a going concern. They made a lot of money. There were a lot of people employed. But then the iron ore ran out, and the mining operation shut down, and all the jobs were lost.
Right.
There was an effort to bring a prison in to Desert Center as a way of sustaining some of the locals' ability to continue to live there. There were a couple of retirement communities that were started that never made it big, just because of the lack of water. And Larry and Donna just did their farming, and would go to farmers market to sell their products. And they mobilized a large conservation movement against the idea, and received probably all, if not certainly a large percentage of their monies from private individuals donating to their cause.
Wow.
And did most of the work pro bono. But they eked out a living, and we're just totally committed to turning those acres back into the National Park Service area, part of the park, and thought that it should be a historic area or an educational area. Total crusaders. Unfortunately for them, with the advent of solar energy in the desert southwest, several large solar farms have been installed close to nearby Interstate 10 from Coachella Valley to Phoenix.
Hmm.
And one of them was built on BLM land that surrounded their property on three sides.
Oh, and that would take out the jojoba. Gee.
Well, their jojoba continued to grow, but just, you know, from being, from moving to Desert Center, you know, 30 years prior, being out in a remote area, they loved the desert. And then, ironically, be surrounded on three sides by a solar farm.
Right.
Kind of changes your view of the desert.
Yep. Well, it changes the desert in a solar farm, does it? It's, yeah, it turns into a wasteland.
So,
hmm.
Eventually, the idea of the garbage pit on the southeast corner of Joshua Tree National Park was defeated, and Larry and Donna were quite happy and hoping that the Park Service and Congress would step forward and add those lands back into the national park. But another company came up with an idea that they could drill some wells into the aquifers of the desert, pump the water into holding facilities during the night, and then during the day, when they'd use electricity from the Southern California Edison grid to pump the water up the hill. And then during the daytime, when you can sell electricity for more than you pay for it, they would run water down some turbines and generate electricity and sell that to power companies.
Pump back storage. Yeah.
Yep. And that took on a whole another story or saga, and what was going to happen with the Eagle Mountain Mine. And the last time I checked on it, it was still being considered. After I retired in 2010, I just didn't track that stuff as much as I was before.
Right.
So There was the Eagle Mountain Mine, which I hadn't mentioned. There's Larry and Donna Sharpeed, Buford Kreitz. And Buford was an ardent conservationist.
Mm-hmm.
And he had worked on several other projects to make sure that they were properly mitigated. One of the most wealthy housing areas in Palm Desert, the developer came in, and maybe he was mayor of Palm Desert, but anyway, the developer came in and he basically told the developer that you're not building what you're talking about building. You're going to build it this way. So Buford had a successful, respectful career, conservationist, and as a mayor. And Buford and I actually became pretty good friends.
Cool.
Because of his conservation ethics. It's just sometimes you find strange bedfellows, and sometimes you find that, you know, the Sierra Club is supporting one plan for the Coachella Valley at the expense of Joshua Tree National Park.
And that the club has a long history. I mean, I don't want to defend the club carte blanche, because they do have a long history of doing things like this.
For what they see as the greater good.
Yes. I get that. I certainly understand it. I don't agree with it at times, but I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fascinating. You know, you take some land away from a national park, you dig a big hole in the ground, you don't fill it back up with the dirt you dug out of it, and then, you know, you sort of leave it to the free market to decide what to do with it and pump back storage or filling it with garbage. You would expect these things to sort of pop up, and it would it would be interesting because you'd sort of stand back and say, "Oh, wait a minute, you know, that hole in the ground needs to be filled back in again. That land needs to be rehabilitated, and then we put the whole thing back in the park."
Similar to coal mining in the east.
Yeah, except mountaintop removal just totally decimates that whole concept. But yeah, I mean, just it's where. It's, I guess, the concept of superfunds, where the taxpayer ends up paying to have the lands reclaimed after extraction. It's a complex issue. Kurt, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned something about the magistrate court when you were talking about the climber who built the fire on the boulder. And I had heard about the magistrate court at Grand Canyon, and I asked some people about how that worked. How did the magistrate's court work for Joshua Tree?
Pretty much the same way. When I arrived there in 2002, magistrate's court, I believe, was monthly. Grand Canyon, I think it was weekly.
Okay.
We had a resident.
Would a judge come out to the park, and would you hold a hearings there in the park buildings, or was there a courthouse somewhere in the valley, in the Coachella Valley, that dealt with that?
When I arrived, we were still holding court in one of the Park Service buildings on the east end of the park, just north of the town of Yucca Valley.
Okay.
But that's since changed. And Magistrate's Court, I'm not even sure where it's held now, but it's held probably every 2 to 3 months. So all the court cases, all the tickets that are written that aren't paid, people want to go to Magistrate's Court, are, you know, delayed by 2 or 3 months, and then the magistrate's court is held. The testifying rangers go down, and the magistrate's court, as do the defendants, and the magistrate rules. And that's
who, the way it is. Who was the magistrate when you were a superintendent? Do you remember?
No, I do not.
Okay.
Could have even been on a rotating basis.
And were those rulings, for the most part, you know, the kind of rulings you would like to see, or were there times when the magistrate ruled against the park and you had to deal with that?
Well, most of the time the magistrate ruled in favor of the Park Service because the evidence that was presented was clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a dog in the backcountry,
right?
People don't come in and say, "Well, I didn't have a dog in the backcountry." They come in and say, "Well, I just wanted to go hiking with my dog." Pretty hard to argue that, no, I didn't climb up on a rock and pour a gallon of white gas on the boulder and set it on fire when Park Service presents pictures of the can of white gas and the fire and the destruction of the fire. So, by far and away, the citations written for environmental protection are pretty easy to prove. It's the more complex cases which can end up, just like Bill Keyes's gunfight, ends up with the Sheriff's Department and county court, because there's concurrent jurisdiction in Joshua Tree National Park, and the more significant cases are usually taken by the county.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I just wanted to kind of clarify how that worked there. So it's interesting. It sounds like, as superintendent, you you probably tried not to take sides in these sorts of things, and yet you did when you needed to. You mentioned between Buford and Larry and Donna.
Well, the job of the superintendent is to protect the national park at which you work.
Right.
So, that's, I guess it's taking sides, but it's looking out for the greater good of the park according to policies of the National Park Service.
Right.
Just that, like,
that's a good side to take. I mean, that's your job.
Yeah, that's what the people pay you to do.
Right. And I'm surprised, because it would be interesting to do a Google search and just see what happened, what was the outcome with that land, the Eagle Mountain land.
Imagine it's still going on, but I just don't know.
Okay.
And then there's, you know, there's all kinds of stories in the desert about water issues. Unfortunately for the park, we didn't have water, accessible water underneath the ground of the national park, but just like at Eagle Mountain, on the north side of the park, north and east, is the Cadiz Valley, which has a huge aquifer. And I'm sure that you're familiar with how the water issues that have surrounded Los Angeles and the Owens Valley and just Southern California just doesn't have water.
Right.
And it imports water. And there's another issue with companies that wanted to pull the water out of the Cadiz aquifer and transport it.
How do you spell the name of that aquifer?
E-A-D-I-Z.
E-A-D-I-Z. Okay.
C-A-D-I-Z.
One more time, please.
Charlie Alpha Delta India Zebra.
Thank you. All right, Caddis. Okay.
I probably used two different.
No, that's good. Charlie Alpha David Indigo Zebra. It we got it. Okay. So that aquifer had good potable water, but the aquifer under the parklands wasn't potable?
Well, it's not accessible.
Oh, not accessible, okay.
Yeah, Bill Keyes and the Keyes Ranch.
Yep.
Head of a small valley. And it just happens to be a place that when it rains, water flows into that drainage. And his ranch actually sat 40 to 70 feet above bedrock.
Ah.
And so 40 to 70 feet of sand, which was eroded over the geologic time, water flows into that area and seeps into the ground and is held by the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
So when he built his dams, it just increase the height of where the water was naturally held anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned he had like seven wells, which were all hand dug, six or seven.
Right.
His hand dug wells were 40 feet deep. But if you go outside of that valley where all the other miners had their mines, they didn't have water in the ground. They couldn't access water because it was too deep because the bedrock was gone. Well, it wasn't gone. Bedrock was much deeper.
Hmm.
So they relied on rainwater, and they relied on spring runoff, and they built small catchment basins, just like the cattle people had, their cows. So but that's one of the reasons that the cattle will move higher by Big Bear, because of lack of water and lack of rain in the summer, except for the monsoons. And of course, the heat, when it's 115 degrees,
right,
cattle would rather be up where it's 80 degrees. So, and it's the same reason that you can locate Native American concentration points when they were traveling through, with matates next to rock outcroppings that have oak trees growing in them. And they knew to go to there because the oak trees would still produce and they could grind the oak acorns,
mm-hmm,
for their grain. So water in the park, in the monument, was hard to come by. But if you drill deep enough, you can access water.
Hmm.
It's not going to be economically viable to transport, and you're not going to have enough in the park. Cadiz, on the other hand, is a huge aquifer. There's been a successful farm in the Cadiz area for decades.
Wow.
They just have decided that they can make more money by selling the water out of, quote, their aquifer. Well, in many cases, aquifers interconnect. And if you pump water out of the Cadiz, you're going to affect the water flow from the north side of the park into the Pinto Basin. And many of the springs will become depleted, and that will change the vegetative type in that area of the park.
Right.
All these efforts on the outside of national parks, you've mentioned a couple on the north side of Grand Canyon, north side of Yellowstone, all have potential impacts to the national parks.
Right.
Which is something that the superintendent and his resource management staff have to deal with.
Right.
So those are some of the things that I thought about from the time of our last interview.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you had your hands full.
Kept us busy. Kept us busy.
So at one point, retirement must have been looming large. And were you looking forward to that, or were you not looking forward to that?
No, I would say looking forward to it. After 35 years, I felt that I had reached a point where I was ready to retire.
Okay.
At least that's so. In October 2010, I retired from the National Park Service from Joshua Tree National Park as a superintendent. And another fella, whose name will probably come to me once I think about it, transferred in from Yosemite and became the superintendent. Interestingly, just as I had mentioned in the past, that the chief ranger of Olympic National Park that was hired instead of me when I applied for the job, The superintendent as well, came as a DS-13 from Yosemite as a landscape architect, promoted to a GS-14, and 2 years to the date that he was assigned to Joshua Tree, he also retired.
Wow.
So he went, maybe it was 3 years, with his high three as a GS-14. Didn't have to pay for his travel expenses. Government picked that up. And off he went. So,
you know, let's talk about that for a minute, because I've heard of this before, the high three concept, where an individual is getting close to retiring, at least, and they may be aware of it. Nobody else may be aware of that. And they accept a job and get an increase in salary, and after 3 years, they can retire from that job with that higher salary, and their retirement will reflect that higher pay. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, your retirement is on your last 3 years of salary.
Okay.
And, you know, depending on how long you've worked, whether or not you've been in law enforcement or not in law enforcement or firefighting, you either get 2% or 2.5%. So you could retire at 30 years and get 2%, so that's 60% of your salary. Or you can work for 35 years at 2% and get 70% of your salary.
Hmm.
Or you can work for 30 years at 2.5%, whatever that is, 70%, or 80% of your salary. So if you are earning, $5,000 more on average, then that increases your retirement.
Right. It sounds like I wouldn't say a catch-22, but people wouldn't necessarily be the right people for the job. They would be looking at the job as a way to help their retirement.
Well, yes. I'd have to say that every promotion I got, I looked at as not only an opportunity to go do something challenging, but it's going to be, I'm going to go from a GS-7 to a GS-9.
Right.
9 to an 11, 11 to 12, and you work your way up. And, some folks that were more aware than I were aware of the SES program. And, I have to say, by far and away, the people that get into those positions are highly motivated. And some of them, no doubt, came for 3 years or 4 years, not only because of the salary increase, but because they were committed to protecting the parks.
Nice.
So I don't want a picture of just everybody's taking their high three and calling it good and coasting along.
Okay.
Because I think I've stressed it, but I would stress it. I think the Park Service employees that I worked with and socialized with were very high quality people for the most part.
Nice.
Can't say that about a few of them. By far and away, they were, and I believe by far and away, they still are. But, you just shake your head after you've been someplace for 8 years. Somebody comes in and you've been someplace at Olympic for 7 years or whatever it was, and somebody else comes in and takes the position that you thought you could do a better job at, and then 2 years later, they're gone. And part of it is you've worked so long with the people that are at the park, you have a great deal of respect for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see 2 or 3 years as an adequate amount of time for a new person to come in and support the programs. And make sure that what the park is working on is furthered. So.
Right. And it seems as though it takes a while to pull together, people in maintenance, people in interp, people in resource management, people in administration, to make a team of people that you've worked with in the past that you would love to work with again, because you know that they're good people for the resource and good people in general. Nothing lasts forever.
Right. And to sustain your relationships that have been built, you know, Ernie Quintana built an amazing support for the national park at Joshua Tree.
Hmm.
And I was able to come in and continue that support. Even when certain congressmen lost, we had new congressmen coming in. We knew the committee staffers and we knew the congressman's people. And so we were able to continue those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't do that in just 2 or 3 years.
Right.
Not that I'm vindictive or anything.
No, this is a reality of what it is. I mean, I see that here at Grand Canyon as well. New superintendent has been in job 6 months, relying on his administrative assistants. There were two actings before him and another short-term superintendent before that. As you say, it's demoralizing for the staff, and it's really difficult to keep the resource from all the threats it's dealing with. Maintenance issues, I mean, that's not Grand Canyon specific. It's got to be all the Park Service units themselves.
Especially the medium-sized and smaller parks. Unless they have the congressmen and the senators supportive of their parks. they have a hard time getting appropriations.
Yes, yep.
Which harkens back to the fee collection program and the distribution of funds for the smaller parks, which I think has been highly beneficial for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting web.
Yeah, yeah. Does Joshua Tree have any concessions?
Well, they have climbing concessions.
Okay.
You're familiar with Grand Canyon and probably other parks as well.
Yeah.
But there's no, other than roads and campgrounds, and trails. There's no infrastructure in the national park.
Okay.
There's no hotels. There's no tramway. There's no golf courses. It's just desert. And so the surrounding communities have done a pretty good job of providing those types of amenities. So folks that come to Joshua Tree stay in the local hotels or the bed and breakfasts or the Airbnbs. And then they go up into the park or they stay in the campgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one or two folks that provide commercial horseback riding, very small scale, into the park. But mostly it's the climbing permittee or concessioner on just a totally different scale. And I believe that one of the things that has helped protect Joshua Tree is no water, there's no electricity, few roads, very limited cell phone access. So it's pretty much just like Mojave Preserve. And a lot of Death Valley, it's a desert. I mean, you go and visit the desert on its own terms.
Yeah. So. I'm curious about the climbing concessions. I'm thinking about the Tetons out of Jackson there, where the do-it-yourself folks would be up some route, and they wouldn't be moving fast enough, and the climbing concessions folks would just sort of climb right through them. How did you sort out those use issues between different use groups, one for pay, trying to look at a time schedule, and one for enjoyment, on a little different time schedule? Are there just so many places to climb in Joshua Tree that wasn't a conflict?
Yeah, there's so many different places to climb. Joshua Tree is the routes are shorter.
Okay.
So when you go and climb in Yellowstone, you know, you're recreationally climbing El Capitan. It's a long climb.
Yep.
But there's an ability to get around the ones that are climbing slower than you. If you've got a 180-foot two-pitch climb in Joshua Tree, that's not going to take all that much time to wait. And there's usually a route that's, you know, 50 feet over to the right or 50 feet over to the left.
So lots of routes. It's not like there's choke points on one route up to the summit of some mountain somewhere. That's a help. That's a plus.
And there's a lot of bouldering, as opposed to climbing.
Okay.
A lot of free bouldering. And actually, there's a lot of free climbing too. But it's not a 1,000 feet. It's 100 or 200, 250.
Mm-hmm. Changing the subject here for a minute, I think. The first female just free soloed El Cap in a day. It's just remarkable. It's like just remarkable.
Yeah, free climbing is something that I find amazing. To have that much confidence, it just amazes me.
Yeah, me too. I'm just blown away. But anyway, sorry, I digress. No, it's just you know, interested in youth group conflict, which sounds like Joshua has very little of. What was the percentage of your climbing concessions? So thinking about overall use of climbing, how much of that was concession based? That's 10 years ago, so I'm sure things have changed since, but.
Yeah, climbing use was estimated at 15%, and when I was there, left in 2010, I've heard that it's 20 to 25% now.
Okay.
I know that for a fact. The amount of climbing concessioners or permittees is basically the same companies, and how many folks are actually taking up versus total climbing, I'm just not sure.
Okay.
I mean, there's so many different areas to go. To take your day client, you know, two or three different routes. Two or three different areas that you can go to and just not run into anybody.
Which is really nice. I mean, it'd be nice for the clients, it'd be nice for the guides, and it'd be nice for the climbing public who doesn't have to worry about somebody else breathing down their neck.
Yeah.
All the way around.
You know, I've mentioned before that there's still, it's easy if you go away from the visitor use areas, you can hike all day and not see anybody.
Right.
Or see very few people. And it's the same with climbing. I mean, the folks that make their living doing climbing, they know where they can go and not be stacked up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So what was it like as an individual to retire as a superintendent from a national park and then suddenly find yourself as an ordinary citizen again, just like any other tourist?
Well, it was an interesting transition.
How so?
Well, as I frequently told people, as the superintendent, I got invited to a lot of events, but they weren't inviting Kurt Sauer. They were inviting the superintendent of Joshua Tree National Park.
Right.
And when you are the superintendent of a park, Here's a funny story. Everybody in the park knows who you are. And a funny story is, after I'd been in the national at Joshua Tree for a while, one of the rangers told me, well, you know that every time that you come in the park, we announce it to our entrance station people and the rangers that are on patrol. I said, you got to be kidding me. No, you're the superintendent. We need to know where you are. Now, that could either be good.
Uh-huh.
It could be, oh, my God, I hope he doesn't go over here. So now you're retired. And, you know, for the next 6 months, it's like, I think I'll go in the national park. So you drive up to the entrance station, and there's Bob, and there's Jane. And, hey, how's it going? And you go through the campground, and there's the maintenance workers that you've interacted with, and they're all like, hey, how's it going? How you doing? Everything's good. And then a year later, I think I'll go up into my national park, and you pull up to the entrance station, and it's like, I don't know these two people. They're first year seasonal. They have no idea who you are.
Right.
And it's about that time that you kind of go, you know what? I think I need to buy an annual pass. Because it's just easier. People have this concept that if you're a Park Service employee, that everything's free. You can camp for free, you can get in the park for free, and that's not the way it is. If you're an employee of that park, you can get in for free. Well, it used to be that you could get in for free. Now, if you're an employee of the park and you're not on duty, you need to have a pass. And you certainly can't camp for free. So, it's just different. You still knew a lot of the people, and you still ran into the folks in the community that still viewed you as the former superintendent. But you just, at least in my case, you became your own private citizen.
Right, right.
And, I was still involved. I was heavily involved in the local community. You know, we created the Mojave Desert Land Trust. I was a part of that, not a large part of it. I was several local conservationists that created that. And so they still wanted me to speak. But over the years, and, I had lived in that community and was well known in that community. And over the years, that just sort of faded away. And I continued to get invitations to, the general on the base would have an annual law enforcement appreciation dinner. And the county sheriffs and the park rangers and the highway patrol and other agencies were invited. And I continued to receive those invitations as the retired superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way the military does it. But it was, again, it was the retired superintendent, not Kurt Sauer.
Right.
And that was interesting. I knew that was the case, that I was invited to these places because I was the superintendent. But over the next course of the, course of the next several months, those invitations faded. And people in the conservation group or the people in city governments, town government, still expected me to show up, but it was as a retired superintendent, not as the private citizen, Kurt Sauer. And, that was an adjustment. It was, in my case, it was a good adjustment. I found myself sitting out on my front porch at 10 o'clock in the morning having a cup of coffee. And a fella stopped by and he said, "How you doing this morning?" I said, "You know, I'm doing really well. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm having a cup of coffee. I got a good book here. And I'm just enjoying myself." So it was a relief, and it was a transitional period, which in my case didn't last all that long, but the retirement process, actually I've told many people this, when I would, on that morning, several other mornings, I could actually feel my brain rewiring. It was a weird physical feeling. I didn't have to deal with all the stuff that was going on. Didn't have to be thinking strategically. You know, you could just go out and tend your garden, take care of your cats. And it was quite a relief, actually, now that I think about it.
Nice.
So that lasted for about 2 months. And then I received a phone call from the deputy regional director of the Southeast region. I think it was in November. I retired in October, early October. So late November. I received a phone call from the deputy regional director of the Southeast region, which the Southeast region was at the time dealing with the Deepwater Horizon BP oil spill. And he asked me if I could come down to the oil spill based out of New Orleans to represent the Park Service, actually initially as a liaison officer, and ended up on the BP oil spill for 2.5 years. Initially as a liaison officer and then as the incident commander for the Department of Interior in a multi-agency unified incident command organization led by the Coast Guard, which is another thing that I thought about in the past. And the Coast Guard, when I was at Olympic, maybe we'll get back to that sometime, and the Tenu Maru oil spill. Anyway, so...
You know, Kurt, we've been going for about an hour here, and I would like to hear more about this, about the Olympic oil spill and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill by British Petroleum. Would now be a good time to wrap up this part and then come back for yet one more oral history to talk about those two events, what you learned from the first event and what it meant to be incident commander for the Department of Interior for the second event.
Sure. And then I'll quit coming up with stories.
Well, I don't know. If you keep coming them up, I'll keep recording them. All right. Well, great. With that, this will conclude part 11, oral history interview with Kurt Sauer. Today is November 8th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. November 9th. Sorry about that. And Kurt, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.